Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and this is the Healthy Options Program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today on our Healthy Options Program, we welcome back Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. We spoke with her last year, and we've invited her back to get an update on what's happening in the world of Maine Council on Aging and the world of older Mainers and older people in the country. The Maine Council on Aging is a multidisciplinary network of 140 businesses and community members working to ensure we can all live healthy, engaged, and secure lives as we age. As the Council's Executive Director, Jess Maurer is a leader in the efforts to implement policy changes on issues related to ageism, equity, poverty, housing, transportation, employment, and care. Quite a list, and it's very, very important, Jess Maurer co-designed the Leadership Exchange on Ageism, definitely want to hear more about that, an innovative program which has inspired over 350 leaders to take meaningful action on ageism, with the goal of ending ageism in Maine by the year 2032. This program is now being replicated in other states and is launching nationally this year. As an attorney, Jess Maurer worked for 17 years in the Maine Office of the Attorney General, where she dealt with many legislative public outreach initiatives on a range of issues, including domestic and sexual violence and elder abuse. Welcome back to Healthy Options, Jess Maurer, and thank you for making the time to speak with us again right here on Healthy Options.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me back.
So, can you describe a little bit about what your what the work is that you're doing? What is just a general overview of the how would you describe the work at the Maine Council on Aging?
Well, I would say that the work and sometimes people sort of have a hard time understanding is to make sure that our policies in Maine, and that can be at the town office level, all the way up to the state and federal level, that our policies are aligned to support the needs of older people generally, and very specifically people who are living into their 80s, 90s, and 100s. And I'll just say that we are in an incredibly interesting time in human history, right? Forget about everything else that's going on, but in human history, worldwide, our population has collapsed. And really over the last 50 years, we've seen a decline in birth rates across the globe. And it's something that population demographers say is not a problem. It's not something to be solved. It's just where we are. And at the exact same time, we're living exponentially longer, right? So 30 years longer in this country, and it's all happened in our lifetime. And so what's happened is that our systems, our normal way of operating in the world, haven't really kept up. And so one of the things that we do when we say we're working in all those systems is we're trying to say, well, look, a lot of times at some point our housing doesn't work for us, or we may live rurally, and all of a sudden, if we can't drive, we can't continue to live in our homes. And so, and because of this population collapse, we have fewer providers of all kinds. And so how do we deliver services in other ways and make sure that people can continue to stay in their communities, because it's really good for them to stay where they are with their social connections, their networks, the people who can take them to the grocery store, instead of saying, okay, well, you can't stay in your community, you got to move somewhere else, and then you're isolated, you don't have access to the things you need, and there are all these problems. So really, we're kind of a problem-solving organization. And at the exact same time as we're working specifically on issues, we're also working on sort of the root cause of not being able to make enough progress in this area, and that's ageism.
We might think we know what ageism means, but how would you define it?
So it's pretty simple. It's prejudice, bias, stereotypes based on age. Okay, that's as simple. So it's how we think, how we feel, and how we act in relation to that bias and stereotype and prejudice. And I like to pick on me. I mean, first of all, literally, we will all be victims of ageism and have been because we were young, because it also affects young people, right? We are all ageist. And I always like to say, and we'll all benefit from trying to reduce ageism across the whole lifespan. And so in my mind, I live in Harpswell, and I live down 12 miles down, a road that's just one lane each way. And if I have a slow driver in front of me, who do I think that is? Well, I think it's an older person. And most of the time, remarkably, it's not, which is very funny, right? But it's the stereotype. And so it's just a simple, but we carry these ideas around with us all the time. And we ask folks to tell us when we talk to literally thousands of people in a year about ageism. And we'll ask folks to say, what are some of these stereotypes? And we just shout it out. And we create a word cloud over and over and over again. And it's the same words. And it's so fast. It's so fast. It's top of mind, the stereotypes. And they're all negative that we have about older people, right? They're slow, ugly, poor hearing, poor eyesight. Conservative comes up all the time, won't get technology, right? All of the normal stereotypes. And then we hold these things about ourselves, right? Decline is inevitable, right?
Senior
moments, my favorite.
Oh, horrible. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the idea here, right? Is that's ageism. And then when we act on it, right? When we act on those thoughts or feelings, then it's really harmful. And we talk a lot about what that harm is.
And the harm is that, what, we lose self-respect. We miss out on the opportunity of connecting with someone with experience. What else?
We don't get jobs that we need and are qualified for. And that really starts about 50. On a regular basis, as a matter of fact, we've had staffing agencies tell us that they have had employers come to them and say, don't send us applications of people over 50. Like, that's how blatant it is. Illegal age discrimination. We hear about it everywhere we go. We thought we were going to talk about implicit bias. Oh, no. This is like a real thing. It's really overt. There's a lot of it out there. And so this is where our cultural normative beliefs about older people and being old are in real conflict with where we are as a state in particular and as a region in relation to our workforce shortage. So, the Chamber of Commerce and Maine Development Foundation, they created this Making Maine Work report that really highlights how do we solve our workforce shortage. And in 2013, in their first report, they say, people over 65 who are not currently working are probably the best solution to our workforce problem. We worked so hard to get anybody to get any traction on that. And it wasn't until 2023, 10 years later, the same report says the same thing. And it really says, no, we're serious. We're serious here. Older people over the age of 65 are the solution to our workforce shortage. And I'll tell you a funny story. So a person who is the board chair of the Maine Development Foundation and Yellow Light Breen, who runs the Maine Development Foundation, were up in the county and having a conversation about that report. And they were talking about all the other recommendations. And the board chair said, well, what about this recommendation about older people? And the response was, we don't think that's right. People aren't going to work up here. It's not like, so it's not even, we're in real conflict, right, between what we think over here and what we need to do over here. And this, I'll just drop a little stat here for you. Our economic development plan says we have to add 75,000 new workers to our workforce in Maine. And the number of people in Maine between the ages of 65 and 74, 186,000. 50,000 of them are working. So you do the math. We have this huge trained, experienced, right, workforce, untapped, and we still are letting this bias get in the way. Well, and that's what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. They just can't think clearly, really. They've lost, you had a birthday, and therefore your cognitive ability has just declined. And sometimes it does, but that's not what we're talking about. It's that
No,
is a
it
normal part of being. But for a lot of people, they're people who definitely would want, right, and have to be in the workforce. This is not always a privilege. It's actually a necessity. So how do we talk about that aspect of the bias and the ageism?
Well, and that's a part of what we talk about. And I want to say there, A, first of all, 56% of older people over the age of 65 say they want to continue to work, not have to work. They want to continue to work. The thing is they want to work at a pace that they want to work in. They want flexibility. And that's where the rubber really meets the road, is that we haven't, particularly in some of, and I want to shift to healthcare for a second, in some of we have such a workforce shortage in so many areas in relation to healthcare, like nurses, for instance, but all kinds of other people. And we just haven't figured out, we haven't figured out how to help shift the way we think nurses have to work, right? Which is weekends and 4/12s or whatever it is they work, and night shifts, and it's rigid. And so of course you get to retirement age and or place where you can leave, you do leave, because that's not how you want to continue to work. But you have all this incredible knowledge and skill you've built up, and we haven't figured out how to say, no, stop. Don't do that. Stay here. Let's figure out how to keep your skills here and create flexibility. So we have so much ground to make up. But I do want to say, because you said, sort of what are the other challenges with ageism? And another huge challenge with ageism is poor health and poor health outcomes. And it's remarkably complex in the sense that it's driven by my own thoughts, right? Internalized ageism. About what's normal in older, right? In later life. You mentioned dementia. I might in fact think that memory loss is normal. And because we have this senior moment thing, right? We're reinforcing this idea over and over and over and over and over again that that's what's going to happen. And we're all terrified of that happening, right? And we're sure it's going to happen. So we're all looking for it, right? And we have anxiety about it. All bad, 100% bad. And in fact, it's bad for your brain to have anxiety about those things. And the reality is, like 13% of people, in this country have cognitive decline. And I always like to say, that means 87% of us will not. Okay. So we're worrying about stuff that's unlikely to happen. But the key here is I talk to geriatricians all the time and they say there is no such thing as normal memory loss, right? Like real memory loss. Like forgetting, having known Bob your entire life and forgetting his name, totally normal. We do that at every stage of life. Your brain is full. But they say, like if in 4 days from now you don't remember Bob's name, that's memory loss, right? And so one of the things that happens when we have beliefs about what's normal aging, normal aches and pains, right? Normal memory loss. We think that's normal. We don't actually go and get help when it could be all kinds of other problems, health problems. So that's internalized ageism can keep me from seeking treatment that could, in fact, make my life significantly better.
That is, I want to really let that sink in, everybody out there who thinks that you're losing your memory. You maybe get the help that you need, but also understand what's normal, and that, as the geriatrician said, memory loss is not normal, so don't expect it. How about that? If you've just tuned in, by the way, I'm Rhonda Fineman, and this is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. We're talking with Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. I think that's really important about this idea of what we think is normal and what really is. I'm really so struck by that last piece of information. If 87% of people do not have cognitive issues, why aren't we focusing on that?
Yeah, well, and I'm gonna blow your mind a little bit, which is to say, first I want to talk about. So I was just saying that's internalized ageism, but because ageism is pervasive in all aspects of life. It also impacts the fact that we don't have a lot of geriatricians and we don't get a lot of training in the healthcare profession about the care of older adults. And so those very same stereotypes actually show up in doctors and nurse practitioners who don't know that there isn't such a thing as normal memory loss because they've never been trained. And they actually think memory loss is pretty normal with aging. And so follow this theme for a second, right? You've got a parent who is experiencing significant memory loss, who is completely in denial about it. And you work a year and a half to get that person to go in to get screened, and they go to their regular primary care provider who has no training at all. And they say, no, you're fine. You're fine. I just had this great conversation with you. And it's totally normal to be a little forgetful at 86. Not helpful, right? Because there's so much new treatment and good treatment that can, in fact, delay the progression of dementia if you get diagnosed and you get in to see a specialist and get some treatment, right? So these are like both sides of the coin, all driven by stereotypes. But I want to answer your actual question, right? Which is, what, isn't it amazing that what we think is driving all of this, right? The flip side of this is that if we live with age positive views, if we don't have anxiety, right? If we actually listen to this idea that, oh my God, it's very unlikely that I'm going to have dementia. If we let go of this anxiety and worry about what it's going to be like to be old, and in fact, embrace the idea that getting older is a good thing, it's a positive that we can actually live our lives well right up until the very end, which I think is the goal for everybody. People who have those positive views live 7.5 years longer with fewer chronic conditions, with less anxiety and depression, and more importantly, have better brain health. In fact, what we think drives our health. And so critically important to stop being all freaked out about getting old and instead really embrace all the gifts that come with aging.
So the mind-body connection, it shows up yet again. I am thinking of the disease of going to your doctor when you're over 65. as in, literally, I often say to people that when you go to your doctor with whatever it is, your symptom or whatever your concern is, say, and if I were 45, how would you treat this?
Yeah.
Because of the bias that would just what you're saying, oh, that's normal. That's normal. No, that pain really isn't normal. That pain is, I've gotten up every day and moved my head for 75 years, and today I have positional vertigo. What's that about? And, you know, it's not because I'm 75. Okay. So the disease of being 65 and older and being minimized, that your concern is minimized, as if we don't really have to explore this further.
Yeah, I mean, this is the disease of normal aging, and it doesn't exist, right? Normal aging doesn't exist. If you've had a healthcare change, then there's something wrong. And so we've actually been able to catalog situations where unfortunately, actual death has occurred. But, you know, people who have gone to seek care when there have been significant changes quickly, and or real changes in chronic diseases that someone has had their entire life, and they go to their doctor who has been their primary care provider, who has treated their chronic diseases, and they say, you know, Mary, you are 94, in relation to the question of why is this getting worse? And in that instance, I know somebody who actually had that happen, who said, well, I'm going to get a new primary care. And she did. And she got better and is just fine at 95 now, right? I mean, this is the reality is that this causes real harm to people. It causes and death. It does, in fact, but it starts much earlier than the 90. So we just did a bunch of listening sessions earlier this year with older people about ageism and healthcare. And a couple of my colleagues who I know well came. They actually came because they wanted to hear, but then they ended up participating. But two different stories from 60-year-olds. One heard herself exercising and went and tried to get care. And the doctor said, how'd this happen? And she told them. And he said, well, you're a little bit too old for that, don't you think? 60. I'm like, she never even said what it was. But I'm like, I don't know, possibly what you're too old for at 60. And we want to be exercising, right? I mean, we want people to be doing the getting out there and being healthy, right? That's how we stay healthy. And the other one said, you know, she was in there for something else. And the doctor said, you know, tell me what you do for exercise. And she put off this long litany of things she does for exercise. And he said, wow, that's really impressive. She's like, it's normal. It's like what people do. But for 60, all of a sudden, it became really impressive.
And the other thing is the schedules for testing. So we have a situation that I'm familiar with where we had a very healthy friend in her late 80s and was fine, you know, active, totally social, doing everything. And then all of a sudden she didn't feel well. And what it turned out is that she had colon cancer. But they said, oh, after a certain age, you don't need whatever, you don't need to get a colonoscopy. She would have been perfectly willing. She listened to that. Had she actually had her colonoscopy at 80, they would have found the polyp, and chances are she would not have died from colon cancer.
Right.
And so so we have to look at the that kind of thing as well. And I want to just talk about the idea of a geriatrician, which
Can I say something about that, though?
Oh, please, please, yeah.
Because that's exactly the problem of what we call a blind spot, right? It's a blind spot because we're living longer, right? That we do not routinely, like, go to the American Board of Internal Medicine and review what those recommendations are about stop getting your mammogram, stop getting your pap smear, stop getting your colonoscopy. Well, I think those were probably fine when you lived to 76, but with your predictably living to 100, we have to recalibrate that. That's another 25 years. Of course you need additional screening. And this, I mean, these are driven by policies. This is where we get into systemic ageism, right? Because CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who are the primary, right, the primary payer here, say we're not going to pay for screening after 85, right? Because we don't see the value of that. And so that's ageism that is built into the system.
Yes. We're just taking a moment. Everything that Jess Maurer is saying requires a moment of breath to take it in afterwards, because this does affect all of us. Even if you're 45 and 35 or 25 listening to this program, this is really essential for those you love in your family and eventually for yourself. The idea of the geriatrician, the specialist on older adults. Now, there are not enough of these people, and it doesn't make as much money as, let's say, or isn't as glamorous because of this, right? As an orthopedic surgeon or a heart surgeon or whatever that may be what you went into medicine for. I don't know, but the point is, do we need to have specialists doing this, or do we just need to have this be part of medical training and that every physician who graduates, goes into general practice, becomes that orthopedic surgeon, whatever it is, that we're all on the same page in terms of these issues?
I'm going to pull that again for one quick second, right?
Please.
Which is to say, we're the oldest state in the country. New Hampshire is right. I mean, Vermont is second and New Hampshire is fourth. Now, the whole region, all of New England, is all in the same boat. We're all in this demographic. And so think about this, right? 29% of our population is already over 60. We have 11,000 babies born every year. We have 24,000 people turning 65 every year, right? And it's not going to change. This is not going to change. And you see, and we need to learn from other countries. In China and Singapore, they're already making those big shifts of people who have been in childcare into elder care, right? Because this is happening worldwide. This is not a phenomenon. It's not about our children leaving. It's all about none of us having enough babies for the last 50 years, and the ship has sailed. There's no way around it. We're done. And so to answer your question is, I mean, more than 50% of all adults in Maine are over the age of 50. Okay. So there is no way, again, that ship has sailed. Geriatricians, we're never going to have enough of them, period. And so the latter part to, you know, question or answer is exactly right. We have to embed, right, good care of older people into all of our care systems and quick, right? And it is different, right? You do actually have to know about dementia, but you also have to know that dementia can come at any age. And so you've got to be aware that if you've got a 40-year-old showing up saying, I'm really confused about why I can't keep stuff in my head, you got to screen for dementia, right?
That's right.
And if you've got a 65-year-old saying the same thing, you got to screen for dementia, but you also got to know that drug interactions could cause that, or a UTI could cause that, right? I mean, like we have to understand, right, that these things aren't always dementia. And if something's presenting in a young person as young as 30, 20s have been diagnosed with people, you know, we have got to embed this really quickly. And there's some great models. So like Dartmouth Hitchcock, their geriatric workforce enhancement program has focused on this premise exactly. We're never going to have enough geriatricians. We do need specialty care. And so it's critically important we continue to have specialty care, but we need to embed these concepts into primary care. And so what they've done is they've taken the Medicare payment codes and they've said, if you manage your population of older patients using these codes effectively, you are providing good care to your older patients and you're bringing resources into your primary care practice such that you could pay for the management, the efficient management of your older patients, right? And they've proven it over and over again, and they're getting better results, right? Better health care. You're getting better health outcomes. And it goes right back to this idea that, right, we have to be keeping people healthy because we don't have enough health care. I mean, it used to be okay that we were only paying for things when people got sick. But without enough people, we don't have enough surgeons. We don't have enough just people to care for the big serious health problems where many of us are going to have, or our family members are going to have. We just don't have the clinicians who are going to be able to do the work. And so it becomes paramount that we keep people healthy, that we really focus on preventative care. And again, like even public health has to make that shift. That has been a huge blind spot in our public health system, is addressing these issues related to aging and healthy aging and all of the stuff we just talked about, right? Age positivity leading to good health. Well, they all want to manage chronic conditions. And I'm like, how about if we prevent them?
Well, that is, of course, one of the biggest questions about how we face health and healing, that it is, you know, in the work of East Asian medicine, it really is about how to maintain your jing, how to stay as healthy as you can versus just treating the symptom or just treating the illness or waiting till you're really, really sick. And the way I already know, I can give you another example of someone I know who really needs a very creative endocrinologist. Endocrinology is all about the glands, and there are so many things that happen in our bodies based on that whole system. And she's a perfect candidate for a really good endocrinologist. And what she learned is that she wasn't sick enough. They would not see her because she was not sick enough. Mm-hmm. And she is, by the way, in her late 60s. So would they think her symptoms were important enough when she was 35 or 40? We don't know. But the point is, so there's a whole systemic thing as well. And she had to leave the state. to find someone. Yeah.
So I think it's important, and I hate the hate. Well, no, I don't. I feel like, gosh, I am. I just want to challenge all of us to understand these external forces that we, you know, that we kind of think this is all our problem or our fault, right? Because we live right with this idea of individual responsibility here. But you just brought up Eastern medicine. And I keep going back to this as a worldwide phenomenon that's happening, right? So other places are experiencing exactly the same thing that we're experiencing in, you know, in New England, in this country. I always say it's coming to a theater near you, the rest of the country, right? But in Japan, so we haven't, in this country, what we say is we haven't aligned our health span with our lifespan. So we're living longer than ever before, but we're living unhealthier years. And in Japan, right, which is an Asian country, they live 12 healthier years than we live. Well, so they, and what do? They do Tai Chi outside every single day. And you can get a pickup Tai Chi, you know, session wherever you are. And they live in community. They walk everywhere. I mean, like they have built health into their culture. It's a part of their culture and they're winning. And what we do are we're outspending all of the other, we're the dead last in longevity, by the way, the dead last for countries like us, we're dead last and we're spending the most. Because we continue to spend to treat the problem instead of building that culture that supports good health.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Healthy Options Program right here on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and our guest today is Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of Maine Council on Aging, and we are discussing essentially how to stay healthy on Healthy Options. So we know the problem at this point, and so what's happening? You talked about Dartmouth, and that is an amazing program. You said I know that you've started a leadership exchange program that's going national. Tell us more about that, and what else is happening with the Maine Council on Aging to address these issues, which are so prevalent.
Sure. So 2020 really hit us, COVID hit us over the head with a 2x4. And the definition, right, of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And when we saw the overt ageism in the country, and my favorite example is the lieutenant governor of Texas said that older people would be happy to die. His exact quotes is, grandparents would be happy to die so that we can reopen the economy for their grandkids, right? And I know an awful lot of older people who are like, no, I don't really think so. That's not really true.
Not so much.
So we, but here closer to home, a Westbrook city councilor wrote on Representative Gatine's Facebook page, we shouldn't count the deaths in nursing homes because those people are only waiting to die. Yeah. And so we said, oh, and they had, you know, they had T-shirts made that had the coronavirus on them that said underneath boomer remover, right? So we said, okay, if we're going to change these systems, all of these problems we were just talking about, right? Housing, transportation, the delivery of care across all settings, right? Food insecurity, social, exclusion. If we're going to change all of these things, we have to address the root cause, which is ageism, which is what we think, feel, and how we act, and how we do that internalized with each other, interpersonal, within our institutions, and within our systems. And I've already given you examples of all of those kinds of ageism in this, 30 minutes we've been talking. And so we said, we did know one thing, and this is a really helpful thing. So Frameworks Institute's a national organization, had done 2 years of empirical research on what older Americans think about aging and older people. And what we knew was that they didn't think ageism was real. And if these are what Americans think, Americans don't think ageism is real. And if it is, it's not as bad as other forms of bias. But what we also learned from them is that giving them a simple example, which I've already given you, a 50-year-old who's totally qualified for a job, can't even get an interview, because people think they won't get their technology, or they'll take too long to train, or they'll cost too much. All of things I've heard directly from main employers. Okay. Then they know that's wrong. And they say, that's not right. That shouldn't happen. People should have a shot. So people can very quickly understand what ageism is. And then they all of a sudden understand their part in it. And they actually are much less likely to act, which is the key here, right? They might still feel, they might still think that's not a problem, but they are less likely to act on their thoughts and feelings if they understand it. And so that's when we started the Power and Aging Project, to have conversations, right? Have conversations. And we do that all over the place with every group or anybody who's listening. If you want to have a conversation like this with the people that you work with or your community, your church, whatever, we're happy to have this conversation. That's our Power and Aging Project. And it works, but it's not enough. And so that's when we said, we have to go deeper, right? And so I happen to have participated in what's called the Leadership Learning Exchange on Equity. It helps white leaders understand white privilege and understand our obligation to be anti-racist and to show up on a regular basis. And it really helped me. And I was going through the whole program thinking, God, we have to do this for older people too, for ageism, right? So I went to one of the designers and I said, would you help me? His name's Craig White. He said, yes, he's from Maine, but he lives in North Carolina. And he helped me design, us design, and we had all of our leaders helped us. I didn't design it. It was a joint effort. This thing called the Leadership Exchange on Ageism. It's a 14-hour peer participatory learning experience for leaders of all kinds. We've had 350 people graduate from the program here in Maine. We've replicated it in Oregon. And we just graduated, I'm not kidding you, yesterday at 4 o'clock, we just graduated our first national cohort, which was really exciting. We're very excited about it. And that was a pilot. And we're offering that in partnership with the National Center to Reframe Aging. So it's really cool. I mean, we're doing a lot of work. We've since then, I just want to say this program has been evaluated over several cohorts. And has been evaluated to, it moves people to take rapid action to disrupt ageism within their spheres of influence, because it creates this, what it's called the disrupting dilemma in the people who go through it, because it challenges their own internal beliefs and it helps them understand how they operate in the world and how their own actions are driving these really unintended, right, results of ageism in our culture. And it's funny because we started, the national cohort started with leaders who've already been trained in this because we wanted to test it out. This is the way we started here in Maine too. And to a person, we've had them do commitments at the end. To a person, they were all saying, this really helped me understand. I still have a lot of internalized ageism I have to work on. And so, and somebody said, you know, I've finally today really got it. Like, unless we, no matter what we're doing over here around age positivity and, you know, all of this other stuff, if we don't get to this place, you know, if we don't solve the way we think and feel personally about aging and older people, we're not going to get to over here. And so that's what this program is all about, is really helping leaders. And it's been transformative. I can't tell you, we've had commissioners and sheriffs and CEOs and, you know, all sorts of 5 different people from L.L. Bean and, you know, Hannaford and its banks and state officials. And so, like, you know, like the state HR person came through, and then the state became a certified age-friendly employer. And then we trained all state employees on ageism and are collaborating with them on how they're working differently to keep older people in the workforce longer in state government. You know, I mean, so it's really, I've worked in change issues for a long time. I've never seen anything like this. Like, because it's personal, people change, and they change, and then they want to go back to their organization and change. So it's actually pretty rewarding work, and remarkably, the work we do is remarkably simple because it's based on the idea we have to have conversations, like one-on-one conversations, and that's the only way we're going to sort of flip the script on aging and being old.
So we also have to work on the practical level of getting a, you know, people who don't have a car and they have to get to the grocery store. You know, we have to work on that level. And then we have to work on the systemic level. And we have to be able to hold all of that. These are not an either or. This is absolutely simultaneous. And, of course, the elephant in the room with the culture that we're in at this moment, where everything is this sort of thing that we're talking about is being dismissed. How do we maintain that in our local communities? How do we keep this prevalence? Because obviously what you're talking about is not going away because somebody says this doesn't exist.
No, and it's funny because I was just thankfully, and you know, if anybody's you know listening, shout out to the Maine Women's Lobby. I just went to their Justice and Gender Summit last week and listened to a wonderful woman who's talking about women's productive anger, and she did this incredible sort of laying out of how women have really launched. The civil rights movement and the women's movement and the labor movement in ways the stories aren't told, right? But in ways that, you know, they were angry, they did productive things. And 90 years later, we have some, you know, we're making some progress, but of course, right, with a lot of these issues, we're right back into not making progress. And I think her point couldn't be more important in this moment, which is that it takes a long, long time to change cultural narratives and views, right? Just in a general way. And we've been building this particular cultural narrative view about aging and older people, about old being bad for a long time. So we're not going to just turn that around in a second. So you're exactly right. We have to deal with the crisis that's in front of us. And there are a lot of them, right? And we could start with the idea that people who are on SNAP, and we're talking about tens of thousands, right, of older people who mostly live rural, who don't have access to food pantries, who have barriers to accessing food pantries, i.e. can't cook or can't drive to the food pantry, can't chop a rutabaga in half because of their hands. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of right challenges. We have to solve for those things as they are coming up. We have to fight like hell. Sorry if I'm not allowed to swear, but we've got to keep standing up over and over again. But I got to tell you, there's nothing more important than doing this culture change work right now. And this is why, because you've got some listeners. and even just, you know, in our conversations, every conversation we have out there, this is us. This is going to impact us. This is the only bias that is going to impact everybody. Every human being is going to experience probably every human being who's past the age of, you know, probably 18 already has experienced it, right? And didn't like it then. And sure as heck, I promise you, you're not going to like it on the other end. But this is personal, right? And so this is about changing the future for me. And we also have to be thinking about a couple of different things. I say all the time, I start every presentation with older Mainers are our fill in the blank. And it's very interesting. I'll ask you, older Mainers are our
resource.
Try again.
Responsibility, haha. Our our strength.
Good catching.
Yes. Our neighbors are us.
How about
our strength?
Future.
Future. Yes.
That's the thing. I'm trying to get people to understand.
We are us.
Do you know that the game of life ends at retirement?
I know. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I do remember that little thing that you had in the middle.
But the new one, it ends at retirement. You win when you get to retirement. And that's the end of it. And so we've got to write a different chapter here because we got 30 new years of life. And we have a responsibility for us making these changes because it's about us. It's for us. But it's also for the next generation. It's also for the next generations. We are going to have to work longer with more flexibility. We have to build longevity-ready communities, and we have to align our health span with our lifespan. This isn't just about older people. It's about the next generation. But here's the other part. So there are our future. Older people are our future because we need them to work and stay healthy and contribute, right, to all sorts of aspects of society and family and community, right? The flip side is also true. How, if we don't do those things, there we are going to be in a world of hurt because people are in crisis currently, right? They are living in houses that don't work for them. I mean, in horrible, horrible situations. They do not have enough food. They are socially isolated. They do not have access to transportation. In this state, in this very state,
yes,
you can qualify for nursing home level of care and elect to get home care, and your plan of care can say you need transportation to the grocery store, but you can get a ride to the doctor, but you can't get a ride to the grocery store. So you can't actually stay healthy because you can't get a ride, right? I mean, like, our systems are completely wrong. And so, you know, like, we're going to pay for it one way or another. Either going to benefit from seeing older people as an asset, right, as a good thing and an important part of our community right up until the very end, or we're going to ignore it, and it's going to cost us a lot of money, and it's going to result in a lot of human suffering.
Well, I will tell you, first off, if you have just joined us, I'm Rhonda Fineman. This is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. We're talking with Jess Maurer, the Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. I want to go back to one thing that you said for sure. I love this, that we have to align our health span with our lifespan. Is that how we said it? Our health span with our lifespan. And I also want to say, when you talk about nursing home quality care, have you been in some nursing homes recently?
I have been in them, but I haven't recently.
Tell you that the great exception is the really good quality, wonderful, beautiful, healthcare, supportive, nurturing, healing environment. And many of them, I will say this as a generalization, I know, have become, based on Medicare or reimbursement, it's a financial thing, and that a lot of people are warehoused. So when we talk about positive aging, and we get back to this idea of whatever you want to do is don't end up in a nursing home. So if we want to talk about lifespan and health span and what it is and how we maintain that when it's too much for a family member to take care of, or you can't be in your home anymore, it's very, very scary. And the other aspect is when we're talking about ageism, so being someone being stereotyped, and then also on top of it, being a person of color, being somebody who's getting an LGBTQ person, or someone else who has another, we're adding to that level of distress. So I just needed to throw that out, is how do we figure out another system to maintain and help people who don't have a family to move in with or don't have.
You're moving right into the most important part of the conversation. So you've done a nice job moving exactly where we need to go, which is exactly, which is that we have this understanding of individual responsibility, and it basically takes hold in when we turn 18, right? That for the rest of your life, you're responsible for how well you do. And I like to always start this conversation with the question of what happened in 1974. Women got access to their bank accounts. They could open a bank account for their very first time. They could have a credit card in their name for the first time. They could get a mortgage in their name. Women didn't have control of their money. Women are the ones who take care of kids, and they are the ones who take care of older people. They come, so they may have a career, but then they come out of the career. They get penalized. They're not paying into Social Security. They're not paying into their retirement. They come back in. They come back in making less money. They're already making less money for women's work. And even if they're working in a male-dominated field, they're making less than their male counterpart, right? We did a report on the economic status of older women. If you haven't seen it, look it up. And this is all cataloged in there. And then, of course, somebody who is an older person in their life, could even be their husband, needs care. They come out of the workforce again. God help them if they're over 50, because when they come back in, they are going to be making significantly less. And, right, what happens, you also, of course, during this trajectory, we got divorced. And so a lot of women lost anything that they did have and are living alone, meaning that they're struggling to meet all of their basic needs on one income, not on two, right? And this results in something that people can understand, right? So this, because this is everybody's story, and a lot of people, you know, including, you know, heterosexual male, you know, men who are, you know, white and lots of privilege, can understand because they've seen their mothers go through this. They saw their mothers struggle as single parents, right? They know that this is true. And so we can really attach to this idea. And so then if you understand that white women, I mean, all women live in poverty at significantly higher rates than men, older men, older women, then of course, you can also understand that in 1968, when the Civil Rights Act was enacted, which was also not that long ago, that people didn't have access to education, right? And of course, housing or healthcare, higher education, right? So you can understand why women of color have older women of color have significantly higher rates of poverty, right, than white women, right? So we can start to look at, by the way, I think this is an incredible opportunity. We can start to look at what happens, right? What is the result of bias over a lifetime? Because we now have people who have experienced those biases and are also, right, have been disabled. 1990, Americans with Disabilities Act. 2020 was the first time the Supreme Court said that the Civil Rights Act applied to LGBTQ people in employment, right? Before then, nationally, you could discriminate. So it makes a lot of sense that people who have been historically marginalized have fewer resources later in life, which means you're much more likely to be accessing that nursing home that you described, right? Because they cannot afford private pay and they are going to qualify for main care or Medicaid expended funds to support them. And we have to understand that when we make these changes to Medicaid, what we are doing are harming people, older people who have experienced a lifetime of economic disparities already, right? And the private, and so we have to, I mean, there's so much in this. We need quality nursing homes. If you've ever tried to take care of somebody with dementia and Parkinson's together, and you know, they're 250 pounds and you're 100 pounds, it doesn't work. You can have 24 hours, you can have all the resources you want. We need good quality nursing home care, but it needs to be sited and developed in a different way. It has to be in communities, not hidden, right? Right. We call this segregation when you get too old, and it's terrifying, right, for people. We need community-based. I have one literally a mile away from me, a greenhouse, you know, 8 beds, 6 beds. I don't remember the number. Yeah, I've been there. It's a lovely place. It's a family. They all eat at the table if they can. You know, it's right on the ocean. It's very pretty, you know, but it's private pay, right? I'm guessing I can't afford that when it's, but you know, for the people who can, and I've heard people say, you know, God bless that this is here, because I can go and have lunch with my husband every single day, right? And his friends visit every single day, right? These are the kinds of things we want. We should be putting nursing homes in the library, in the elementary school, you know, in town centers where you have to go in to interact with people, right? And because you have to see it every day, you make sure that it's quality and you make sure everybody has access to it, right? And other countries are doing this. I'm really excited to go to a conference on Sunday hosted by Leading Age National. And there's a lot of international people who are coming. I'm going to go to all the international sessions because I really want to understand how they've done this, right? How have they been able to do the things we just can't seem to find out? And I'm just going to say it all comes back to this idea of individual responsibility. We haven't built it because we think people are individually responsible for this, but I just say this is a collective responsibility, particularly because of what I just said around the fact that people have fewer resources later in life based on things they had no control over, right? People say, well, they made bad judgments, you know, bad decisions. I'm like, well, they made the very best decision they had out of very bad decisions, right, that they had to make. And the reality is I can't change Maine's transportation system. Well, I personally could, but most people couldn't. And I can't develop housing, right? Right. I can develop housing policy, but I definitely can't develop housing. You know, I can't manufacture more people. I can't. And so we have to do differently. Right. We have to really change our systems about how we work and how we incentivize people to take certain jobs like healthcare jobs and care jobs, period. So these are big systems issues. And I can't personally affect how Medicare pays for my treatment at 65 or says that I'm entitled to it. So the reality is if I need a colon screening and I'm not entitled to it, the only way I'm getting it is if I'm paying for it and I don't have the money to pay for it. So I'm not going to get it and I'm going to die earlier. And so we have created a system of have and have nots, and the chasm is just getting wider. Huge. And wider and wider. Yeah. Sorry. Well, that was a lot.
No, that's fine, Jess. We only have a couple of minutes left, very quickly. But I do want to say I did remember reading an article. One of the Scandinavian countries where there was a housing for older citizens, and then some of the kids were going to college, and then they needed the university, and they needed housing, so they moved in in this complex. So everybody was together, and the elders were making dinner, and then the younger people were making dinner, and then they were doing things together, and it was like, oh wow, like real life. You know, instead of isolation, there was a sense of community.
That's happening in many places, not just in Scandinavia country. And we actually have a couple of models in this country, but very few. And I think you're getting to the last point, which is really important, is that while I say we have got to address ageism against older people, because, by the way, it does result in death and or, really bad health outcomes, we have got to have conversations about aging and normal and healthy aging with younger people. And younger people say exactly the same thing that older people say, that they are not connected to community, that their voices aren't heard, and that they're spoken down to, right? All of these things, they're not included. So we have great alignment of what older people and younger people are feeling, and we've got to start that conversation in a real way.
Oh, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Our guest today has been Jess Maurer, Executive Director of the Maine Council on Aging. Thank you so much for joining us again on Healthy Options. And the website is Maine Council on Aging. That's M-A-I-N-E, as in the state of Maine. This show and information that was mentioned will be posted on the Healthy Options Archive in the Public Affairs section at WERU. Get the ERU app and you can listen as a podcast. Thanks to Joel Mann, Amy Brown, and WERU for engineering support, to Petra Hall, our co-producer, and as always, thank all of you, our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Fineman wishing you the best in health.